We continue with our sermons in the book of Genesis and turning again this evening to chapter 25. Book of Genesis in chapter 25. We take up our reading this evening at verse 19 and read to the end of the chapter, and in fact it's that whole portion that we're going to look at this evening. The book of Genesis, chapter 25, from verse 19. And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said unto her, "Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over like an hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field. And Jacob was a plain man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And Jacob sowed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die. And what profit shall this birthright do to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day." And he sware unto him. And he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink, and rose up, and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Amen. Last week we looked at the death of Abraham, and as we reflected on that full life that Abraham lived, both as a man of great faith, and also, you remember, as a man whom God had raised up to show forth something of his purposes of redemption in his life in this world. If we were to have a verse to begin with this evening, we might take it up in that verse 11 where we concluded last week. And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac. As one old writer says, God buries his workmen and carries on with his work. And how true that is. And now that dear old Abraham has finally passed off the scene of these pages of the book of Genesis, it is Isaac his son and his son's son Jacob who now begin to almost completely dominate the pages that are left until the end of the book. So as we move on this evening, we come to look then at the latter half of this 25th chapter of the book, containing the birth of Jacob and Esau to Isaac's wife Rebekah. And then that famous incident in the life of Jacob and Esau, where Esau sells his birthright, you remember, to his younger brother for that ill-famed mess of pottage that we read about this evening. Now, I want us to take both of the incidents together. It's a big piece of scripture, and yet I want us to see both of them running side by side, the birth and the selling of the birthright. For as one of them sets before us a new factor, a new aspect in God's unfolding purposes of redemption, so the other sets before us something that ought to run alongside this new factor or this new aspect of redemption that's now set before us. Now what I mean is this. We've seen surely in this book of Genesis how God progressively reveals things to us in his word. We live in the blaze of the New Testament day. We know, as it were, the things that were taking place. However, when God was revealing his will, he was revealing it progressively. So you start in the Garden of Eden with that very small seed thought that there will come the seed of the woman who shall bruise the serpent's head. And then on right through the book of Genesis until surely, as we've seen in the life of Abraham, you get so many aspects of God's covenant of redemption being shed out for us there time after time after time. Now you remember one of the greatest. Remember it was this, the way that men and women will come into salvation, the salvation that God has provided for them, namely by faith. You remember, he believed God, says Paul, and it was accounted unto him for righteousness. And here's how men and women will come into this salvation which God is providing for them, will provide for them, through Christ his Son. It will be by faith, and if the life of Abraham ever teaches us anything, it teaches us how men and women are redeemed, how they are saved. They are saved by faith alone, by believing what God has said and done through Christ the Son. And for all generations to come, that is marked down by grace you are saved through faith. And in the life of Abraham, that surely is set out for us. Now, as you come to the life of Isaac and the life of Jacob and Esau and this birth of Jacob and Esau, you see now how you're confronted with a new aspect with regard to this revealing of God's way of salvation for us. And that new aspect is this, my friends. It's God's purposes in election. Now we're being told how a man or a woman or a young person really comes to salvation in Jesus Christ the Lord. Those electing purposes of God, of course, have been present in Abraham, but they haven't stood wide open, as were. They haven't been made bold. The thing that's been made bold in Abraham is that we come to Christ, if you like, by faith. We are made right before God by faith. But now, you see, as Isaac goes and entreats God on account of the barrenness of his wife Rebekah, as Rebecca conceives, as that struggle takes place within her womb, as she goes to inquire of the Lord why these things are, and the Lord answers her and tells her those words about the elder serving the younger, you're right into this aspect of God's purposes in sovereign election for those who will come into this redemption which he is providing through Jesus Christ his Son. So that Paul takes it up to him. And he says that it was so that the purposes of God according to election might stand. It was said unto Rebekah, the elder shall serve the younger. And so it's election to salvation that you're now being shown on the pages of this book of Genesis. Now, they are complementary. The faith and the election, if you like, they are complementary. How are you saved? You can rightly say, I am saved by faith. Of course we're saved. In that way, as it were. But now you're being shown, you see, below and beyond that faith, there is something else, namely the working of God. So that what we always have to do is this, we have to get the order of priorities right, something that we haven't done in our day. And remember that when a person exercises faith, they are exercising, as it were, the instrument by which God is pleased to save a man or a woman. But that isn't the end of it. And the faith is the action. But there's something that produces the action, something that produces the life, that produces the action, and that is grace. The grace of God's sovereign election. So that Paul says, by grace, you are saved through faith, and that not of yourself. It is the gift of God. How are we saved? We are saved through the exercise of faith, through believing. But the exercise of faith is indeed the action that springs out of the life which has its source in the absolute sovereign grace of God. By grace, through faith. That's how you see it. And now, having been shown in God's progressive revelation of how he will save men, through the exercise of this faith, now we're being shown the source of that faith. It's by grace we are saved, and grace has all got to do with the electing purposes of God. Well then, as I say then, having come to that then, of course, one thing that the Lord almost invariably makes run alongside passages like this is this aspect of human responsibility, of how man stands answerable before this God. And so you see what you have one after the other, these displays of human responsibility set right into the midst of this great chapter of God's electing sovereign purposes revealed for us on the Word of God. So as I say, those two things then we take up and we look at this evening in this particular part of this particular chapter. Well, two divisions. First of all, some of the lessons then in divine sovereignty that the verses set before us, and then some of the lessons in human responsibility that the verses set before us. Now, first of all, those things with regard to the divine sovereign will and purpose of God in election. You see the whole backdrop. You see how the whole thing is set against this. It's set against the barrenness of Rebekah, the wife of Isaac. Verse 19, and these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah. And by the time Esau and Jacob are born, we're told down there in verse 26, Isaac was 60. So for 20 long years, my friends, they had been married. And they had been married for 20 long years, and at the end of that 20 long years, there was still no sign of a child on the horizon. And remember, in order for the promises of God given to Abraham to come to pass, the one thing that is absolutely essential is this: there must be children. There must be children. Even you remember, as they have blessed Rebekah when she left her homeland, be thou the mother of thousands of millions, they said. What a forlorn hope. And here, after 20 years, there are no children. Not one infant voice has yet been raised in that tent of Isaac and Rebekah, and there are no children whatsoever. Well, it's just like Abraham and Sarah, is it not? Indeed, it's exactly the same. For Sarah was barren. So that if Sarah will ever have the child that God has promised to give, she will have that child when God will come in his sovereign will and purpose, and Sarah shall bear a child as he said she would. Now you've got a replica situation, you see. And how our life and our breath are in God's hands, and in God's hands are all the issues of life. And Isaac, like his father Abraham, knew that well. And like his father Abraham, because he believed the promise that there would be a continuous seed, he goes and asks the Lord what it's all about. And the Lord is entreated of him, of course. But you see the whole situation. 20 long years of marriage and no children. No children, no covenant promise, no purpose in the covenant being wrought out. And as soon as we're introduced to the life of Isaac and Rebekah, as they take over from the life of Abraham and Sarah, it's the self-same picture that's set before us. Man is pressed up to his hopelessness and can do absolutely nothing at all. Now you can just read on then, beginning in verse 21. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord. Now you see, the Lord is entreated of Isaac, Rebekah conceived. And then there begins this inner struggle within her. So much so that she must now go to the Lord to inquire of the Lord what's taking place. What is it that's going on within Rebekah? My friends, the reason for that inward struggling is very simple when all said and done. It's to cause her to ask of the Lord what is happening so that the Lord will tell her exactly what is happening. And through what the Lord tells her is happening, then will come his great pronouncement concerning the eternal purposes of his in electing the men and women, the church, to his redemption, his people, in endless generations to come. Prophetic, of course. Remember way back there in Eden. Remember how the Lord pronounced there that there would be this continuous struggle between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman? Here's the struggle. Here's an illustration of the struggle. Here's the enmity of the two seeds already in Jacob and Esau in the womb of Rebekah, their mother. And the children struggle within her. And already, even right there in the purposes of God, the thing is already said. We're closed up to God. And we're closed up to a God who we might call God and believe what we're saying. Like the state of affairs, of course, when a person comes to faith in Christ, is there not this struggle? It's the same kind of thing. Like the dear old bride in the Song of Solomon, what will you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the company of two armies. How she loved her Solomon at times, and how at other times she drifted far away from him, shut the door, wouldn't even let him into the house. And she says, that's what I'm like. It's like a battlefield. There seems to be a company of two armies in me. What will you see in the Shulamite, as it were, the company of two armies? Well, my friends in the believer, it's like a company of two armies, is it not? For there's our old Adamic nature that we have by our birth, and then when God comes by his grace and grants us a rebirth, then there's a new nature there as well, and there's a struggle going on in the believer. That's the kind of thing that's happening, by way of illustration, in Rebekah at that time. You see, dear old Rebekah is like us all at times. See how she begins to reason there. She knows no doubt that Isaac has prayed to the Lord. She knows no doubt that it's the Lord that has intervened for her. But now she wants to know, why is all this taking place? She says, if it be so, why am I thus? If it's the Lord that's done this thing, then how am I in such a state that I'm in? That's like modern day Christianity. Once you get converted, you don't have any more troubles. You don't have any more perplexities. And you don't have any more pressures. So the people are inclined to say, well, since I've become a Christian, how can I be feeling like this? How can I be feeling downcast and depressed and perplexed and fightings within and wars without and all the rest of it? My friends, read the Bible. And the whole balance of the Bible shouldn't be expressed in, if I am so, why am I thus? But since I am so, I am bound to be thus. That's the whole point. And God has come and God has done his sovereign work in the womb of Rebekah and has done it for his purpose, and that's why she's thus. However, she must needs inquire of the Lord, as I said, so that the Lord will tell her exactly what is taking place. But you see, the stage is set. This is the thing. And the Lord will overcome the barrenness of Rebekah after all these years, but he will overcome it in such a way that will send dear old Rebekah flying to him with her question. And then the Lord will answer the question. And that answer that the Lord gives them has all got to do with his sovereign purposes in saving a people for the eternal praise of his name under the terms of the covenant of grace. Well then, let's look at the answer. In verse 23, and the Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. That answer, of course, is like all the other covenant dealings of the Lord. There are things natural and things spiritual, things physical, and things real in the real spiritual sense of it. There's going to be a natural outworking and a physical outworking, but that natural and that physical outworking is only going to serve as an illustration of the real meaning that lies behind God's purposes here with Rebecca at this time. You see what the Lord's telling her then? He's telling her that she's going to have twin sons. He's telling her that these two sons will be heads of two nations that are going to spring up in the earth. And they shall be as two manners of people, he says. One shall be stronger and more powerful than the other. And then this also, the elder son shall serve the younger son. In the first place, of course, it's Jacob and Esau. And when Jacob finally holds the pistol to Esau's head and virtually robs him of his birthright, then there's going to come to pass that state of affairs where Jacob is going to be head of Esau. Jacob, is, though the younger, is going to be head over the elder, Esau. And as far as the two manners of them are concerned, you'll see from our reading, and if you know the rest of the book of Genesis at all, they were like chalk and cheese in their nature, were Jacob and Esau, as far as outward things are concerned. So as far as the direct application to Jacob and Esau were concerned, then that takes place, that comes to pass exactly what the Lord has said. Because it widens out from that, it widens out into national things. Jacob becomes the father of 12 sons. Those 12 sons become the heads of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Because there comes a point where Jacob's name is changed to Israel. Thou shalt no more be called Jacob. Thou shalt be called Israel, because thou hast prevailed with God. And those 12 sons of Israel then will become the fathers, the patriarchs of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. And a mighty nation it will be that will spring out of this Jacob. And then Esau, you see, after he has sold his birthright to Jacob there in verse 30, then he has his name changed to Edom. And there will spring up a great nation in the earth called Edom and the Edomites. And they'll be perpetual enemies of the Israelites until they're finally brought under subjection in the reign of the great King David, where so many of the prophetic utterances of the book of Genesis come to pass in David, the great King of Israel. And if we want to know anything about that continuous enmity that existed between Israel and Edom, then that's what the prophecy of Obadiah is all about. In the day of thy brother's calamity, thou stoodest on the other side. Jacob and Esau, Israel and Edom, and it goes out and out and out until when you come to the New Testament, which is the final revelation of God, which is the last word on everything that God has ever said in all his word, which is the commentary and the rule of interpretation for all the Old Testament scriptures of God, then you come to the fullness of what was really taking place at that time. And when those words spoken to Rebecca soar far, far and beyond the natural and the physical. Now it's the Apostle Paul again in that famous 9th chapter of Romans, verse 10. And not only this he says, but when Rebecca also had conceived by one, even by her father Isaac, for the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of work, but of him that calleth, it was said unto her, the elder shall serve the younger. Why did God say to Rebecca, the elder shall serve the younger? Says the inspired apostle of God, that the purpose of God according to election might stand. That's it. It was an illustration. An illustration of the electing purposes of a sovereign God choosing out a people who would be his people forever and ever. You've seen how that redemption has been set up and shown forth in the life of Abraham. You see how you enter into that redemption through faith. Now you see what lies far below that again. These purposes of God. These electing purposes of God that bring every man and woman and young person and child who are ever brought to God that bring that person to God. God's electing purpose. Now let me say this. You'll come across people who will say that Paul is speaking here about national things, or else you will come across people who will say, well, it's a kind of conditional thing, this election. Now, I remember when I wasn't long saved, a man saying to me, oh, yes, I believe in election, but only with regards to the nation of Israel. Everybody else has a free will, as it were. But the nation of Israel, it's elect. That's what the Bible means. When it speaks about election, it's speaking about a national election. Now look what Paul says. What's he speaking about? He's speaking about this. He's speaking about the fact that there is no more any Israel as a nation, in fact, as far as the redemptive purposes of God are concerned. And he's speaking about the true children of God, the children of promise, whether they be Jews or whether they be Gentiles. Verse 7 of that chapter 9 of Romans. Neither because they are the seed of Abraham are they all children, but in Isaac shall thy seed be called. That is, they which are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted for the seed. For this is the word of promise, at this time I will come, and Sarah shall have a son. And he goes right back to Sarah and Abraham to illustrate what personal election to God for every child of God. Now see what he says in verse 10. And not only this, not only Sarah and Abraham stand as our election to God personally, not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one, that is our father Isaac. And he's using Jacob and Esau as an illustration on top of the illustration that he's used about Abraham and Sarah, an illustration with regards to personal election, not national election. My friends, don't let anyone take your Calvinism away from you by trying to tell you any such thing. It's one word of God. And he says, Abraham and Sarah, that's where our salvation lies. And not only this, and then he goes on to Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and Esau. Some people say then it's conditional election. The only kind of election that's in the Bible is this. That God, as it were, looked away into the future. And he saw those people who would seek him. And he elected them. He chose them. In other words, he looked and he saw who would choose them. And he said, look, there are people seeking after me. I'll choose them. And I'll make them to be my elect. Now, Paul has already written to the Romans. And again, he's speaking about the self-same situation, that it doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or a Gentile. And here's what he says. What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise. For we have before proved, but Jews and Gentiles, that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. Why don't you see that? Did you see that? All right, suppose this is the case that God looks down to see who were seeking him. The whole problem is there were none. There were none. There is none that seeketh after God. Like that illustration about the handle being on the inside of the door when God knocks in the gospel, but the man's dead. That's the point. Doesn't matter if the handle's on the inside, it's a corpse that's inside the house. And it doesn't matter whether God was supposedly looking to see who would seek him. There weren't any seeking him. That's the point. There is none that seeketh after God. And where's your conditional election? The only election in the Bible is unconditional and sovereign. And it's that the purposes of God according to election might stand, it was said, the elder shall serve the younger. Now that's the prototype. That's the mold, as it were, for all election to come. Doesn't mean that election hasn't been, but now God's displaying what election is like, you see, in the pages of his word. And this is a prototype. Look what it's like. They were both in the womb, my friend. The children, says Paul, having done neither good nor evil. They were in the womb. They were in the womb. Then he goes on and he tells us this, that pronouncement that God makes, the elder shall serve the younger, why, it's contrary to all the usage of that time. God turns the whole worldly usages, as it were, upside down. Upside down. When it comes to choosing between the two people as far as characters concerned, Jacob and Esau, you choose whoever you like. Because I'll tell you this, there's not a button between the two of them. And a more scheming, crooked, selfish, heartless character than Jacob you'll not meet in the pages of God's Bible until God really takes a dealing with him away, way further on in his life. And here they are, my friend. They've both got one mother. Where's your fleshly covenant line? One mother. They were both brothers. They were both twin brothers. What's the answer? Sovereign election. Sovereign election. And when God takes the case of Jacob and Esau as his pattern for his sovereign election, he takes one, my friends, that's closed up at every supposed loophole, and he makes the case airtight, and you're closed up to it. Or you're railing against God's work. Election means election. Sovereignty means sovereignty. Jehovah means Jehovah. And the Lord here has taken and set the case before him. Now bear this in mind. When Jacob there goes a scheming and exploiting a few verses later on, and when Rebekah, his mother, does the same thing so that he obtains the blessing, be sure of this, it's neither of those two pieces of action that gain the birthright or the blessing. That's settled. That's settled right at their birth and before their birth. And where that comes into is the realms of responsibility. Human responsibility. And get the both of them running alongside where they ought to be, but don't try to mix the two of them up, whatever you do, or you'll get yourself into a tangle that you'll never extricate yourself from. And my friends, what does it do when Jacob does what he does over that birthright? Only proves the election. Only proves what a cheating, slimy character he was at that point. Only proves that what he will have, he'll have. Because God has decreed it and said it. So then, you see, that's what's being given to us. Why does God bring us to salvation like this? For exactly the same reason as I mentioned this morning when we were in our sermons in Corinthians. God hates pride. God detests the pride of the human heart. And be sure that when he saves a soul, he'll save it in a way that is calculated to take your pride and mine and put it where it belongs. That's why you're elected to salvation, my friend. That's why you're saved sovereignly. Because all the glory shall be the Redeemer's. And there won't be that. Not, as old Spurgeon says, not so much as one thread in the garment of righteousness shall you sew yourself. It's a sovereign. It's a sovereign. And we're closed up to it. As Paul stands back in all his awe and says, it is not of him that willeth, it is not of him that runneth, it is of God that showeth mercy. Who maketh thee to differ from another? God, my friend. And to God be the glory. A debtor to mercy alone, of covenant mercy.
Isaac.
So then what we are being shown is that covenant mercy of God exercised through his grace in his eternal purposes in election. And the Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. And look through all the pages of the Old Testament, and see how it all came to pass from Jacob and Esau through Israel and Edom, and then bow beneath the scepter of King Jesus, my friend, and realize that our salvation was brought to pass in precisely the same way, under precisely the same sovereign hand of our God. Well, we said we'd look at some of the lessons in human responsibility that the verses set before us. And of course, they revolve mainly around that selling of the birthright by Esau after Jacob has come and, as we said earlier, has virtually held a loaded pistol at his head to get it off him. Now, in both the men, now, let's say that in both the men, despicable action. Despicable action. You choose who you would want between Jacob and Esau for a bedmate at this time, my friends. There's not much to choose between them. However, you see something with regard to this human responsibility, and this is the thing, you see, that you're pressed up to now. And I think that if a person really believes in the sovereignty of God, then the one thing that they're most careful about is their own responsibility before this God. Because if they hold the one so strong because it's the truth of God, they must hold the other equally strong because it's the truth of God. Now you see how all this then practically envelops the sovereignty of God. Before you even come to the children, there's a very sobering word there with regards to responsibility, tucked in there in verse 28 of the chapter. We're told of the birth of the twins, then the names are given to them. Then in verse 27 there we're told the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. Then comes that sobering word. And Isaac loved Esau, it says, because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now there's responsibility. Call it parental responsibility, because it's got to do with a parental sin, and that parental sin is partiality in parents between one child and another. That's a very sobering word. That's responsibility. That's what I mean by human responsibility, my friend. That's what I mean by being able to believe in a sovereign God and yet being pressed up to all the precepts of God's word when it comes to responsible behavior in every aspect of our lives before our God. And that's a very challenging word. Jacob was loved by his mother, and Esau was loved by his father. I wonder why. I wonder why Esau was loved by Isaac. Maybe he saw in Esau something that he never was himself. You remember when we dealt with Isaac later on, he was a timid kind of character, you would say. Now here's Esau, you see, complete honesty. Boisterous, rootin', tootin', shootin', huntin' man. You see how he went out into the field. Perhaps it was one of these cases of attraction of opposites. When he saw that big strapping red-haired son of his, maybe his heart went out to him. Who knows, maybe there was nothing more subtle than he liked venison, especially the way Esau did it. But my, he loved Esau. And then there's Rebekah and Jacob. What did you see in Jacob? Possibly what a lot of mothers or a lot of fathers like to see in a son or a daughter. He'd a bit of a stay-at-home disposition. Jacob was a plain man, dwelling in tents. No, that must have warmed Rebekah's heart. All right. But remember that beneath that exterior, there was a rotten heart.
a rotten, scheming heart.
And my friends, perhaps Rebecca's partiality to that aspect offered Jacob helped to kindle the flame in that rotten heart until it burst out at a dozen and one points in his life. But partiality. The lessons are clear. See how the two no doubt knew how to exploit the respective soft spots in their parents. Esau with his venison for Isaac and Jacob with his stay-at-home attitude, absolutely delighting the heart of Rebecca. You're not telling me the children have changed in Jacob and Esau? Not a bit of it, my friend. You can see some wee boy. Do you never see him setting his mother up for the sucker punch, as you would call it? Or some wee girl, about that height, wrapping her father round her wee finger. Say, ah, that's children. Yes, it's children. Of course it's children. But how do we react? Because this is parental sin. This is parent. My friends, let me speak seriously. God grants us grace not to make fish of one child and flesh of another. And God forbid that any Christian parent should ever say, that one's my favorite. God forbid, my friends. I tell you, God forbid that it should ever cross your lips. That one is my favorite. What a thing to think. Each one, according to need, according to capacity, according to a dozen and one things. But as far as partiality is concerned, God forbid that it should ever exist. Let me tell you this. If children see partiality, then they'll exploit it as surely as Jacob and Esau did. Let me say something I said to myself. I'm not saying things to you that I wouldn't take to myself. My friends, don't you argue over your children in front of your children. And don't you take the side of one child against the parent in front of your children, or I'll tell you this. You're opening up a breach that they'll run into in your married life and you'll rue the day. If you ever did such a thing. Keep a united front. United we stand. Divided we fall. And you better believe it. Bear this in mind as well. In the grace and in the providence and in the purpose of God, we're raising up our children to be wives and husbands themselves. And if a son has got used to pulling the wool over his mother's eyes, he'll do the same with his wife. And if a daughter has got used to manipulating her father, she'll do the same with her husband. We've to train our children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And very often there's a lot of common sense attached to that. That's responsibility. You see, from this electing purpose, you're right down to this. Right into the heart. Right into the first. And what a lot of things there are bound up in that word, and a wealth of meat. For when God will set down strongly one aspect of his character and his work towards him, he'll set down another just as strong. Have a look at the children themselves and the first bit of that afterlife, as you might say. And the last point for this evening. Sure, the details are known well enough. Verse 29, Jacob saw the pottage and Esau came from the field and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, sell me this day thy birthright. And Esau said, behold, I am at the point to die, and what profit shall this birthright do to me? And Jacob said, swear to me this day, and he sware unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up, and he went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Well, there's Jacob. Absolutely heartless. Boil it down into everyday terms. His brother's starving, according to his brother's testimony. And he won't even give him a bowl of pottage. That's it. You see how he's an opportunist. He exploits the situation. Sell me your birthright, he says, and I'll give you a bowl of pottage. But I say, my friends, that highlights God's grace in Jacob. God's grace in Jacob. And if you read the New Testament comments on Jacob and Esau, you'll see two things that are very clear. That what takes place and occurs in the life of Jacob is all in the line of God's sovereign grace. And what takes place and occurs in the life of Esau is all in the line of human responsibility. And that's what you're faced up with here in this buying and selling of this birthright. What was a birthright? Well, normally it meant just that the elder son received twice as much as any of the other children. But you see, this was a birthright with a difference in this Abrahamic line. Because not only were the physical things, the temporal things, the material things, there was something else as well. There was a spiritual aspect. So that whoever continued the line down through Abraham, through that particular line, the promised one was to come that God had spoken about to Abraham. And this is what Esau despised. Don't you see that? Two aspects of this birthright. And knowing Jacob and what we're told of Jacob, my friends, the thing that Jacob was grabbing after was that material side of the birthright. Sell me your birthright, he says, because he wanted his hands on the tents and the cattle of his father Isaac, and he wanted the big portion. That was Jacob, because that's what Jacob was like. What did Esau despise? The material side? No, no. The spiritual side. The fact that through him, humanly speaking, might have come the messianic line. And when you get Paul's comment on it, you see that that's exactly the case. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. A profane person. The Greek word's profanum, it means this. It means anything that has been set aside for a specific holy use and is taken and used for a carnal use. And that's what Esau did. He was a profane person. Because he thought nothing whatsoever of that spiritual aspect of the birthright that was his as the elder son. And he, in fact, with his belly rumbling, he said, promises? I can't live on promises. And he despised. My friends, don't you see the spiritual application? Had Esau been spiritual, he would have starved to death rather than despise that thing. But he did despise it. And so the word of God pronounces him profanum, profane. He took that which was for a holy use and he used it for a carnal use. And that's where the application in the gospel comes in. Oh, you say, what about that God's decree given to Rebecca? Did God's decree given to Rebecca mention anything about Esau despising his birthright? It did not. It did not. That's what Esau did. That's what Esau did, my friend. And that's human responsibility. And Esau did hear what thousands do yet and did after him. They take those things that God presents in their presence, spiritual, holy, blessed things, and they despise them. They despise them. far as the bargain's concerned, well, the bargain's something like Judas Iscariot, my unconverted friend. You see, what some people would reject the gospel for in their life, I tell you why, Esau did a good deal in his bowl of pottage, and Judas did a good deal in his 30 pieces of silver. It's amazing some of the things that make people balk at closing with Christ in the gospel. Just amazing. Come away, what is it? What is it? Tell your heart what it is. Some trivial thing. Yet when all said and done, that old self-life, that old pride, that old self-righteousness, that refusal to bow and say, God be merciful to me, a sinner. But he set the pattern to Esau. Took that holy thing, made it profane, despised it. You see how the whole thing winds up. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Not a thought. Thus Esau despised his birth. But so you see a new chapter opens, and opens with the principles and the characters involved at this point. And the principles that open it, my friends, are these with regard to God's grace. God's grace, that's what saves souls. God's grace, through faith we are saved. By grace, through faith. And God, as it were, launches us right into it, right at the beginning of this new era, as it were, in the unfolding of his salvation. Now, having brought us through all these things, through all those aspects from Adam, through Abel, through those before the flood, through the flood, into Abraham, all those years of Abraham's life, 100 years, and all those aspects of salvation, now into Jacob and Esau and Isaac and Rebecca, and now new aspects. And this to start with. By grace you're saved, through faith. Those that will be redeemed forevermore, the Lord rightly calls them, mine elect, mine elect.